Sustainable Hour.
For a green, clean, sustainable Geelong, the Sustainable Hour.
The Sustainable Hour acknowledges the traditional owners on the land on which we live, meet, work, play and broadcast from. We pay respect to the elders of the Wadawurrung people, past, present and those who will come. At the Sustainable Hour, we take inspiration from the long history of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander activism and a resistance in Australia and seek to amplify the voices of marginalised groups. We acknowledge that there can be no climate justice until there is justice for all our Indigenous brothers and sisters. We know there is much for us to learn from the way they managed and nurtured the land for millennia before their land was stolen by the first white settlers. Finally, we pay tribute to One Fire for the work they are doing in Geelong for reconciliation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Sustainable Hour. How has everyone's week been?
Oh, yeah.
So good, Jack.
So much happening all the time. It's amazing. It doesn't stop.
It doesn't stop. Well, I had my third lesson on the Nature Stewards this on Saturday morning, and we spoke about land care and looking after the land, and it was really interesting. There was so much. Like, I've got some notes in front of me, and we had somebody, a COG biodiversity strategy person, came on. He's a local ecologist. We also had Travis Turner, who is the Environment Projects Officer for the City of Greater Geelong. He was talking about all of the nasties, the weeds and the pests and that sort of thing. But, yeah, just action-packed again. It was really good. So,
and Tony and I, we talked to two amazing nature stewards of the real, in the real sense of that word. On Saturday, we had a Zoom meeting with two women. Tony, you can talk more, but we did a full hour recording of them, which we have put out as a special podcast in our stream of podcasts, you know, the Regenerative Hour, which is a bit of a bonus addition to the Sustainable Hour. I can really recommend, especially you, Jackie, and people who care for nature, you got to listen to this one because, wow, it really comes from the heart what they're talking about. And they are, you know, risking their lives hanging up in 30-meter tall trees to defend these trees.
Amazing. Yeah, no, it's fabulous. But we should move on because we've got a very, very special guest today, and we want to get the start of this show on its way, and we'll speak to Colin Mock and find out about your global outlook. Colin, what have you got for us today?
Hello, Jackie. Yes, well, look, I've got actually four different things, but I'll run through them very quickly. Should you wish, we can go into depth on each of them. First up, I learned a new word this week. It's astroturfing. Have you heard it before?
Yes, I have. I've heard it, but I don't know what it is. isn't it like I'm thinking like a cricket pitch.
Yeah, but yep. Astroturfing, that's astroturf, is a synthetic grass that's used in America, or was used in America until it was found to be really quite poor, because it when the players fall on it, they tend to abrase the skin, and also when they spit on it, it stays there, so they're not using it anymore. But the word astroturfing is a newly coined one in America, and it's used for oil companies or fossil fuel companies who pretend that they are taking an environmental stance, but basically all they're doing is giving themselves a greenwash. They're making it look like they're doing something environmental, but in fact they're just sticking to their fossil fuel agenda. And I think, going back on the last Sustainability Hour, when I pointed out that the Woodside, the Australian company Woodside, had something of a backlash from its shareholders, and 51% of them had voted to take a neutral environmental emission stance. They immediately shut down that meeting, And I wouldn't mind betting that next time Woodside makes an announcement, it will be under the headline of astroturfing, because that's what they tend to do in Australia. But against that, the second thing that I want to talk about today is that the Oxford University in the UK this month put out a study where they had they've looked at the findings from 700 previous stimulus packages on where we've had problems before, mostly from the GST, the financial crisis of the early 21st century. They looked at 700 different economies and how they came back from that depression. And without a doubt, the ones that chose to come back under green economies and looked for sustainable living did much better than those that they termed were black economies, where they concentrated on the previous coal-driven and oil-driven economies. So Oxford University, they released this, these figures. They it's not just a small survey, 700 different economies. They looked at their packages for coming out of it, and they came up with a 100% green look. If you come back green, you get much better bang for your dollar. That's what they're saying. Now, whether our government will take advantage of that, I don't know. And I have grave doubts, to be really honest, because our federal government is pretty much still driven by the fossil fuel industry and supports it at every turn. But we'll wait and see. We might get a bit of astroturfing from the feds as well. And the third one that I wanted to talk about is that the world's largest sovereign wealth fund has dumped its stakes in two Australian companies. And now that's the world's largest investment group, if you can call it that way, is actually the Norwegian Parliament's economy. If you remember, you would know this certainly, Mick. Back in the late 1960s and early 1970s, Norway was among the first to come up with North Sea oil, and they became particularly rich. But they had a socialist-leaning government at the time, and they came up with a scheme that they would invest all the extra money that they were getting from the oil revenues, and they would invest it not just sustainably, but ethically. And they have been doing that for quite a while. It's really interesting when you look at the world and you look at where each nation that makes money from fossil fuels, where it invests it. You know that the Saudis buy football teams and racehorses. You know that here in Australia, we tend to make a half a dozen people incredibly, stupidly rich and just keep the money flowing over it into different people.
What they do in Norway is actually that they, and we could have done the same here in Australia, if over a period of, you know, decades, you say that there is a bit of a tax that you put on these companies that drill for oil and gas and coal. Mm-hmm. And instead of just making that a tiny little tax, if you make it a bit of a bigger tax, and you say that that money is put into a big deposit, and we save that to give back to the communities, to give back to the citizens, instead of it going into the pockets of those people who own the companies. Well, this is basically what happened, and that's why it's the biggest fund in the world now.
Yep.
My point is Australia is sending out billions of dollars every year out of the country. Instead of keeping it, it's just going out to some companies overseas. That's just a pity, isn't it?
Well, you know that I dig back into history. Well, I looked back into the history of the Norwegian oil fields, and first of all, they were all explored by overseas companies, mostly Americans. But then they nationalized them impartially, first of all, and then virtually took over them by nationalizing them. And then they came up with this fund, which was with the surplus money, and they invited the Norwegian representative of Greenpeace to be on the committee that would work out where the money was being invested. And I do believe that they've still got a green presence on the on this particular thing. That this is a group that is working out. I think its actual name is the Norwegian Superannuation Fund or something like that. It's basically the future for Norwegians. But this week, this is the reason that I brought this up. This week, it's dumped all of its shares in AGL, and it also flagged that BHP, they were going to be pulling out of BHP as well. They put it down in their terms as under observation because they don't think that BHP is doing enough to run a sustainable outfit, I think is a nice way of putting it. In 2015, it brought in this policy to divest or exclude all companies that didn't meet environmental criteria. And those two Australian companies are now on the list. They're on the watch list. And I figure that's pretty good news from our perspective because, as I pointed out before, we tend to just allow the money that flows from fossil fuels to go straight into the pockets of Gina Rinehart, BHP, Twiggy Forrest, and these people are obscenely rich and they don't do the things that Bill Gates does by trying to do good things with their money. They just put it offshore so that the Australian taxpayers don't get any benefit from it. Anyway, look, that was the number three thing. And the last thing that I wanted to point out is another one that's slightly related. It's the residents in the Latrobe Valley have lodged a legal challenge with the EPA. They're actually taking the EPA to court because of the time when the Hazelwood Power Station's coal ash dumps is leaching into streams and contaminating their groundwater. And of course, the Hazelwood Power Station is one of our filthy brown coal power stations, which our governments are still supporting. And we should have got rid of them 40 years ago when the truth's known. So there's my four things for this week. You've got a new word, astroturfing. You've got the Oxford University saying that if we come out of this coronavirus, the most efficient way is to come out environmentally. You've got the Norwegian government putting a couple of Australian companies on notice because they're not, in their eyes, green enough. And then you've got a little bit of a backlash from the people of Latrobe Valley who always in the past have been supportive of their coal-fired power stations because it produced jobs for them. Now they're turning green. That's my report for this week.
And what a wonderful way to start this hour, Collins. Thank you very, very much. What you're saying here is, in a very strong way, that the story, the big story, is changing. Mm. And we've talked about that for years here in the Sustainable Hour, that it's only by the time when the story is changed that we'll begin to see change from what we can do as individuals to how the system needs to change. It starts with the story. And that story is changing big time. Every week we see that happening. It's almost like when the Berlin Wall was falling. You know, you get the shock, wow, the story is changing. The walls are falling.
Oh, definitely. You can feel that now. When you get something like the Norwegian Superannuation Fund saying they're going to pull out of BHP unless they clean up their act, that's big money talking. And it's not people protesting on the steps of town halls and things like that. This is something that's really going to have a consequence.
Colin, I have a clip for you that I would like to play for you. And I think you'll be interested in it because it's from a chief economist here in Australia. He's the former executive director of the Australia Institute, and now he's their chief economist. And he was asked a question in one of these many, many Zoom conferences that are happening almost every day at the moment. Professor Fiona Stanley, who works with coronaviruses and epidemiologist.
She's an epidemiologist. She used to be the Australian of the Year.
That's right. So yes. I didn't remember that. That's exactly why she's so famous, because you can hear that when she asked the question, people knew this woman.
Yes.
She basically asked a very, very relevant questions about how do we get the citizen's voice into all of this?
Fiona Stanley, I'm not sure if you can hear me there. Do you have a question for the panel?
Yes, I do. Thanks very much. Can you hear me, Ebony?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Jim, for this. And hi, Richard. As I've got a question which goes from BC, DC to AC. And of course, I'm a scientist, and what I'm hopeful for always that we have science and data driving and evidence driving decision making. If you want to get to a changed shape in the economy, Richard, where's the evidence? How are we going to get that voice of reasonable evidence? Now, BC, we didn't get a fucking, looking. Science has been denigrated. We've been lobbying for climate change and the health effects of climate change. Forget it. It was industry driving decision making and not science. During the, we've become, epidemiologists have become the heroes of this epidemic. We're not just criticised for creating a nanny state, we're applauded because what we're doing is getting us out of this amazing pandemic, and epidemiology and science is now really valued. So what is going to happen, AC? How are we going to get not just science and its really rigorous decision-making and evidence into economic and other decisions, health decisions, and community decisions, but also how do we get citizens' voices? You know, we feel a bit paralyzed that we've got so many good opportunities to get citizens' voices in. And when you give, I work a lot with Aboriginal people, when you give Aboriginal people a voice, boy, are the solutions successful. Thank you.
Thanks for a great question. Richard, I might go to you first on this one.
Yeah, sure. Oh, thank you, Fiona. Look, it's a really important question, and I accept the premise of it entirely, but I would make a distinction. Governments listen to scientists, when they feel like it, and they ignore them when they feel like it. So, for example, the Australian government has been enthusiastic about embracing science when it comes to, for example, something like genetic modification of crops. And when people have said, I'm a bit nervous about that, successive governments have waved around scientific reports and said, you're being crazy. You know, the science has settled. What are you worried about? By the way, I'm not personally too worried about GM crops. I'm just using the example that when governments want to listen to science, they do. And you say that they only listen to industry, you're right, they do listen to some industries. They've listened to the coal industry, they've listened to the oil industry, they've listened to the gas industry. But when the renewable energy industry shows up and says, hey, look at the benefits of us, they get slapped down with crazy populist critiques of climate science, or even crazy populist critiques of how the energy transmission system works. And we get all these sort of armchair experts wanting to talk about synchronous and asynchronous power when they don't know what either word means. So don't get me wrong, I understand entirely what you're saying, but in order to improve our politics, that we need to ask the question, how come governments are so good at listening to some scientific advice? How come when it comes to defence spending, governments are so good at spending money today to protect us from threats in the future? And how come sometimes those same governments ignore science, whether it's epidemiological evidence about the advantages of preventative health, or whether it's climate scientists warning us of some threat? So how come our government can listen to science when it wants to and listen to industry when it wants to and then just be so dismissive of science and industry when it doesn't? I think that's a really harder question to ask. But I think the opportunity coming out of this is the whole world can listen to Donald Trump every day and see what the consequences of science denial means. And listening to that man last night tell me that America is testing more people than anyone in the world and everything's fine. These are the same people that have said greenhouse gas emissions, you know, aren't going to cause us problems in the future. So it's a terrible experiment. But the Australian government has listened to science, it's acted, and it's saved a lot of people's lives. The Americans haven't listened to science, and they've killed a lot of people. I think what we have to do is make sure the public sees the benefits of listening to science all of the time, rather than cherry picking when we want to listen to science and when we don't.
Said Richard. Yeah. Said Richard Look, Dennis.
That just about cements and highlights what we've been saying for the last probably 4 sustainability hours. It's wonderful that for the first time our government is listening to science when it comes to the coronavirus. What we've got to do is make sure that they continue listening to science once we're on the other side of the coronavirus, and then we come back to still facing the biggest challenge that we do face. It's bigger than the coronavirus, and that is global warming.
Hmm. But, you know, I think as much as I loved Richard's reply here to Fiona Stanley, he didn't actually answer her question, which was about how do we get the citizens in?
Yeah.
And I just want to point to that I did an interview with Tim Hollow just a week ago and put it out in another one of our regenerative hours. And I think Tim Hollow really had some good answers to how we get citizens more engaged and involved in this. And it really begins with, it's kind of simple because it begins with empowering that we have more confidence in that it actually matters, that individuals can change this world. What we do in our own house, in our own street, when it is part of something, a big movement in a way, then it actually matters what we do. These little tiny things we do matter. Changing our conscience in that way, that's where it all starts. And that's not about politics, but it is about that we speak out. It is about that we have the courage to go and knock the doors of our neighbors and actually have a conversation with them about how is it going? Can we help? Very equivalent to what the permaculture movement and the transition movement have been doing for years and years. But it's almost as if it's now becoming broader and becoming something that doesn't even have a name.
I think it's maybe it's care. I was in a shop on the weekend and my son was chopping some firewood. We were out in the garden and he wanted to chop firewood. The axe that we had was a scrap metal one that I'd picked up from the scrap metal heap, you know, and it was bending. So he said, "Oh, Mum, what would be a great thing for us to do would be to go down to the hardware store and get me a new axe so then I can start chopping the wood." And I'm like, "Okay, well, let's do that." So we went down there and he got his axe. And as we were leaving, I noticed there was a table at the front. So this is, you know, our local sort of sand and soil place, hardware, you know, dog food, all that kind of stuff in there. And as we were leaving, there's a table with all local producers' goods. So like jams, there was honey, some fruit and vegetables. So the store has actually set up effectively, I suppose, a little mini farmer's market in that like the people that would usually go to the farmer's market now can have their produce on their table in the store, and they're selling it for the store. And so I think that they're not doing that for any cost, like any money gain for them, because they're actually doing it just for goodwill, you know, like just to support the local producers. And, you know, I think that's kind of when you're saying, Mick, like the little steps. It really is just those little things. It's just, you know, like somebody would be in there and think, "Oh, that's nice. You know, why don't I get this? This is jam that the local farmer down the road has made." So it's a really nice thing.
Have a listen here, because we've talked, our chief economist, Richard Dennis, talked about Trump and what's happening over in America. But there's something else going on in America. Here's a little clip from another podcast with Joel Salatin, who's a bit of a guru in the regenerative agriculture space. He's one of those who's been a pioneer in that space. And here's what he's reporting, what's happening in America at this time.
Yeah, they say that a crisis does not create a trend. It simply either accelerates a trend that's already developing, or it brings into broad, a clearer focus a trend that's already developing. A couple of really specific things that we've seen with our farm in the last, you know, 3 weeks is an exponential interest and growth and purchasing of backyard chickens, you know, 3-4 chickens for a backyard flock. I'm going to have eggs. This, and of course in the U.S. now, literally hatcheries, all independent hatcheries are backlogged up to 3 months. You can't buy a chick in the U.S. now. They're all ordered and snarfed up. Mm. Even the New York Times is writing about this. It's in the media parlance, it's called a phenom. You know, it's a phenom. Sure. This new trend. So yeah, that certainly speaks right to your self-reliance that people are engaging in this. And of course, we think this is a great thing. Another huge thing that's happening is all of the little independent seed companies, especially that sell heirloom seeds or non-chemicalized seeds. They are also, in fact, many of them have shut down their websites for 3 days just to be able to breathe and catch up with orders.
Wow.
You know, that has developed as well. And again, I think that there's going to be more gardens put in this year than we've seen probably since the World War II victory gardens back at that time. That also is a very, very good trend.
Joel Salatin, who was interviewed by this podcast called The Abundant Edge, and I think that's exactly what's happening here in Australia just as well. That's what I'm hearing. People are rushing in to start their gardens, and they're beginning to get the point. Right now, entering our tunnel is someone who's made a remarkable push for exactly that, that we can do better. We can do better at home. We can do better in our street, in our community. David Holmgren, welcome to the Sustainable Hour.
Good to be here again.
You are, and for the listeners who don't know you, you're a bit of a guru in not just in Australia, but in the entire world because of something that started all the way back in the 1970s, and it was given a name. We were just talking about that there's a big movement happening, and it doesn't even have a name, but it does in a way because you have been talking for decades about something which is called, and I want you to introduce it. I'm not going to say the word.
Yes, permaculture, of course, coming from permanent and agriculture, but also permanent culture. And, of course, that was a concept coined in the 70s before the sustainability discourse, which came out in, began in the 80s, and captured the imagination in Australia and was taken around the world by my co-originator, a generation older than me, Bill Mollison, and of course it is now a global movement. Most people would associate it as being some sort of cool form of organic gardening or sustainable living, but it's really a design system for redesigning really every aspect of society, but starting with basic needs and starting with the individual, the household and the community level, rather than the usual place where people start, oh, we need to redesign society, redesign the great institutions, starting at the global level. So I suppose over those decades, it's had huge numbers of different expressions in different places, but still the strongest one is this association with people doing more for themselves, growing food, making things at home, being more self-reliant, less dependent on the monetary economy, and not just keeping going the non-monetary things that they do, but actually restarting that economy, which has been sucked dry in the last 40 years of sort of neoliberal policies to grow the monetary economy. So all the things we used to do at home a generation or two ago of now been monetarized, and of course that's made people incredibly more dependent and vulnerable, which the current crisis of course is highlighting for many people.
And what has the crisis meant for you, and how have you felt? You know, are you tearful about what's been happening?
Well, I feel very positive, despite the pain and suffering there's been, and of course in Australia through some combination of being the lucky country again and maybe some sort of more functional policies at the top and being an island nation, we've sort of so far managed to dodge the worst effects. So I don't want to sort of underplay that. But given that we have been societies, and in fact our whole global civilization has just been walking like a zombie into the maelstrom of climate change and resource depletion and ecological breakdown, and dealing with a lot of the economic limits that come from that by actually greater disparity of wealth. So this huge number of things that just promise enormous pain and suffering in the future, it's hard to imagine a more benign way to cause a pause to the global economy, and especially the global economy, the discretionary part of the global economy, the coffee shops, the dog shampoo services, the gymnasia. It so far mostly hasn't stopped, the essential parts of the economy that people are dependent on. We're discovering, of course, how interlinked those are, and, the problems with food supply chains and all sorts of things. But I think that wake-up call for people has been really positive. And for us personally, of course, we live a home-based lifestyle. Psychologically, it's actually been very little change. But in terms of our small business, which virtually operates like a non-profit, communicating our publications and information, like with a lot of people in this field, there's been this huge increase in interest. And so that's been a lot of stresses of growth, I suppose, And I've always said that permaculture is counter-cyclical how the mainstream economy is going, that the interest over the decades tends to be sort of just ticking along in the background when people are confident about the main economy and trust in institutions is high. And then when that turns down, interest in permaculture strongly grows. But we've never seen a growth, like this current one.
Yeah. David, I've had the good fortune to be part of that growth in a way. I'm sure you're aware there's a number of book clubs that are going through, working through that tome that you've created recently. It's kind of, a lot of people are looking on it as a Bible in terms of, not for religious reasons, but in terms of a way forward, how we have to act. Now, you've chosen to market your Retro Suburbia book differently. Do you want to tell us the...
Yeah, well, I suppose the first thing was, of course, in publishing it in Australia 2 years ago, we were printing a very big, expensive book in Australia with Australian printers rather than sending the book to China. And we had crowdfunding to support to help us do that. And we're also, the book was never available on Amazon because we don't believe in participating in predatory systems that suck and destroy small businesses everywhere on the planet. And so we had our own online marketing systems, and of course working with owner-operated bookshops and small networks. So there's been a lot of getting that word out through those sort of permaculture and kindred networks in Australia. But once the pandemic hit, we were on the verge of doing a third print run, which is, for us a big bucket of money to print 5,000 books of that size. We knew there might be a big increase in interest, but we decided to make the book available online on a pay-as-what-you-feel basis to give people access who might not have the means or understand the value in that work for their current situation. We took a big risk with that because that was potentially wiping out the market for the printed book. That has worked really well. The interest has been amazing. And that also gives us the capacity to communicate with people who've effectively members of the online book format and have greater knowledge of how people are using that. And our aim is to sort of try and support local groups. So, of course, it's this dance all the time of using the internet and that network communication to then seed and connect things that are actually happening at a local neighbourhood level.
How do people find the book online?
Well, it's just at retrosuburbia.com, and you can go there and either directs you to, you can buy the book or just get the book online. And yes, there's the real thing. And it's interesting that sales of the hard copy book have actually increased as a result of doing this. And some people, that's been people going, wow, look at this. Yes, this is exactly what I need now. And yes, I want the thing in my hands rather than just being dependent on the internet. So that's been really positive. And of course, we're also able to increasingly reference a lot of the activism that's happening out there. So permaculture colleagues like Hannah Maloney in Tasmania and Morag Gamble in Queensland have been churning out, you know, small videos on a whole lot of, you know, practical basic things. Okay, how do I actually get composting happening at home? I wanted to do it for ages, but I actually don't now, and I need to do it quickly. You know, I want to get this sort of stuff happening. So because, of course, Retro Suburbia is providing that big pattern framework of these issues, there's the built environment issues, the biological and all the behavioural ones.
I obviously have the book, and I bought the book for my sister last year for her birthday. My other sister was very jealous that I bought that book for her and not the other one. So now I had to buy it for the other sister. So I've had to buy that, and then had to buy one for my mum as well. So all up, I've bought 4 books so far, but I've told so many people, other people, to actually get the book. I think that with the book and with the difference between the online and the book, because I've looked at the online as well. The online's great because you've got your links and you can just go to those links. But I think that there's something in having the book. And for me, I pretty much, even though like this is probably one of the heaviest books I have, I just carry it around wherever I'm going. I'll put it down. I'll read that. When I get 2 seconds, I'll read it. But I'm all about, like, I know about permaculture, and obviously I read the book and I look at other books, and I try to do little things. And I'd like to know, how do you think, David, you can get people, just normal people that aren't greenies, that aren't sort of, you know, tree huggers or that kind of person, to actually, like, where do you start? What would your advice be as to, like, what do you start with?
Well, I think for different people, you know, there's different motivations. And obviously the motivations change when you get macro events like a pandemic, where people become very focused on, for example, personal health can become an incredible priority for people, especially if we'd had the more major impact. So you see people going, oh no, my health is really important. Exercise and activity. No, I need to make or buy really good healthy bread from, you know, fermented sourdough grains, because I know about that or have heard about that, but it's never been a priority. So, you know, for a lot of people, there's that sort of like an anchor point of doing something that's within people's means and is meaningful for them. So I've argued that a lot of these actions at this level, the psychological support that those things bring may be initially more important than the actual material self-reliance that activity you know, creates in itself. And that's going to be different, you know, for different people. And I think also, I think the behavioural changes, of course, can apply whether you own a house or whether you're living in an apartment on the 10th floor somewhere, or you're out on a rural property. And another publication that we were privileged to publish in some ways is a companion to Retro Suburbia, and that's The Art of Frugal Hedonism by Annie Razor Rowland and Anna Grubb. And that book is really very much more written not towards people who are interested in sustainability or environmentalism, so just how to live a better way without spending so much money, without working so hard. And I think a lot of the life hacks in that book are a sort of a gentle pathway in. And I know a lot of people who've given that book to friends and relatives who are not so much sort of on the page with these ideas, as a sort of a stepping stone. So yeah, I think that's sort of different for lots of different people. The other thing is, of course, my Aussie Street story, which is a sort of a short story in the book, but it's also a presentation online. And I found that's an endearing way for people to grapple with a lot of the sort of like very difficult issues, especially when I was, you know, talking about the second Great Depression of the 2020s. And without actually having a crystal ball, that it looks like, yes, that's what we're now in and probably heading deeper into. But that, yeah, as through storytelling that builds on our shared history of suburbia, and saying, yeah, well, actually we do have a lot of the resources that we can sort of make changes and live a better life now and deal with, you know, difficult threats that are coming. So sometimes that storytelling pathway is a great way for people to put the toe in the water of what's all this about.
Yeah, fabulous.
You know, relatively modest numbers of people doing things radically different provides a model, and it normalizes that sort of behaviour. But it also acts as a very powerful signal into market and government systems that there's people who are effectively on strike from consuming, on strike from working in the way the economy demands you work, and on strike with the way people have their money invested. But the other thing that comes from that, or the weakness of it, is that it feels like it's very isolated, that there's no solidarity. And the risk that, oh, if I have a compost toilet that is actually illegal, what if the council, you know, comes and fines me? You know, there won't be a bunch of people who arrive at my house and say, no, we're defending this person who's doing a good thing. Whereas when I go and lay down in front of the bulldozer, you know, at a mine or in some great demonstration, or, you know, try and stop traffic in the CBD. Those things, people actually do those things because there's a sense of solidarity, organisation. We're doing this together. Now, my mother always said that the purpose of a demonstration was not to change the public opinion and not to change the policies. It was actually to provide the empowerment to the activists coming together and feeling that solidarity so they could go back and do the real quiet work in their communities over time. And so that understanding has always been there for me. But I think my recent understandings are really we need to bring that solidarity, which we associate with, in ancestral terms, going to the town square to voice our opinion, that now with the internet and communications, we can have that same solidarity at home. And that will allow people doing things at home, those who are more radical, who are wanting to push the boundaries, that they have some support for doing that.
Exactly. And I think that's, David, that's what's happening. We've talked about it a lot here in the Sustainable Hour. And this is why you see a picture behind us on our TV screens here of a tunnel, where back in the 1940s, when Hitler was bombing London, people came into the tunnel, the train tunnels at the time, and they came out strengthened, more determined than ever, that they could actually win this war, and that yep. Hitler was somebody who had to be defeated, and that actually the gas chambers were real. Because the funny thing, and that's really not funny, that's tragic, but people at the time didn't even believe that there was such a thing as gas chambers. It was like, with the climate deniers now, people were saying, no, this gas chamber thing is a myth, it's not even real. And Hitler was not to be defeated. No, we had to negotiate with him, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But the point was, people came out of the tunnels with a new sort of vision from having met each other and having had these discussions overnight. And we feel, in a way, that the Zoom meetings we're having, the digital connections that are being created at the moment, is a new tunnel. Something new is going on here, which is very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting idea of that connection, which is rebuilding while people, have had that time. It's also, of course, this sort of wild card that has been there all along in terms of whether people need to commute to work, because that spell has been basically broken. And, of course, that is one of the basic structural relationships that the retro-suburban, home-based and life is trying to challenge. And we've certainly lived that way for a long time, relying on what communication channels did exist, including, being part of a globally connected world in the 90s just with email and dial-up. And it has always amazed me that this technology's been there, and yet its potential to sort of break some of the patterns of the past haven't been realised until now. And so what that means is, if I can actually more efficiently do things at home, making better use of the huge physical and capital infrastructure represented by people's homes, and I can travel more for special purposes, and social purposes. And at the higher levels, the idea that everyone's got to be on planes flying to conferences and meetings is completely unnecessary. Yep. It shows that actually huge parts of our economy are actually unnecessary. And that those parts represent, of course, a gigantic amount of fossil fuel resource depletion and, most dramatically, greenhouse gas emissions. So that means this sort of, like, such large restructuring is possible. For example, a huge amount of the commercial real estate, I believe, will, after this pandemic, not actually be needed. And that means that building stock can be retrofitted to housing. So that actually means we don't actually need a building industry on the scale that it is, and it needs to be a labour-intensive, small to medium business retrofitting buildings for multiple different new purposes. We don't actually need a building industry in the sense that the government is trying to use it to kickstart the economy again at all. And so these realizations that are sort of slowly dawning for a lot of people hopefully mean that a lot of these discussions, which just go in this trance-like state, we must have a building industry because we have a rising population and we have to do all these things to create jobs, I think can be questioned.
David, you really don't realise it, but you've just neatly summed up the Sustainable Hour's themes over the last 4 weeks. Until you got to that last piece about the building industry, Because you have to bear in mind that, I think it was a little while ago, the Monday the 18th, if my memory serves me correctly, Daniel Andrews, who up until now has been exemplary in his leading against the coronavirus, announced that the package that was going to bring us out economically from the downturn was going to be led by the building industry. And he was going to be building large structures, and he was going to be building, spending money on roads and infrastructure, and he's looking for the building industry to pull us out of it. It's up to us now, I think, to say, hey, no, let's go green. Let's look for sustainable way of coming out. The building industry is not a way out. Certainly building roads is not a way out.
Yes, well, I think the interesting thing there is disconnecting the use of energy and resources, accelerating that and getting the trickle of employment that comes from that, most extremely in the mining industry, but the way our building and development industry is set up to use the maximum amount of materials, energy, and minimise labour and skill. We actually need to rebuild the building industry where we could have still at least 50% of the employment and possibly as much employment as we had in the current building industry, just modifying houses, modifying other buildings, making them more energy efficient, because all of that side of the work is actually very labour intensive and skill intensive. And it's also not amenable to corporate logistics because every building situation is different. It actually suits small and medium sized business. And obviously it will use materials and energy to do that. And we need to reshape things. And there may be some role for, expanded, public transport infrastructure. But that idea that a viable modern society is defined by this constant daily movement of massive numbers of people from where they live to where they work really can't be just taken for granted anymore. And, of course, this projection that, we have to do these things, I think can be questioned. And so that shows that even these things that we think are the basis of an economy, such as infrastructure, well, do we really, need those things?
Now, what's next? What's up next for you? What project? I'm sure you're not just going to sit back and take it easy.
Yeah, well, on the home front, of course, we're continuing things here at Meliodora, where we have three semi-autonomous households sharing the property. On the network and business front, we're increasingly feeding back any profits from the online book projects and other publications back into providing more information and services to people making these changes. Our latest addition to the team is the incredible Charlie McGee of Formidable Vegetable Sound System. He's part of our social media team now. And we've been able to do that because of, this increase in interest. And we've got other publications in the pipeline, a brilliant climate change novel set in the near future by permaculture teacher and author Linda Woodrow. It's a ripper of a story called 470 it will be coming out shortly. And then the other book we've got is a children's book of my Aussie Street story told from the perspective of the children in the street. And that's called Our Street, and it's a beautifully illustrated children's book, and we're hoping to have that out in a few months' time. So there's some of the projects we've...
Yes, lots happening. So that'd be on retrosuburbia.org, is it?
Retrosuburbia.com.
.com. Okay, terrific.
Dave, I was excited to watch Charlie's launch of his latest song, the rap song about the climate movement, and he did it from your place. I noticed that. And you were actually there being presented as well. I was thinking maybe you could introduce what you think about the song. And we will go out on that and play the song for our listeners. But give us a bit of your personal introduction to the song and what it means to you. And also, I'm thinking, because these are very strong words, it is a bit of an anthem for the permaculture movement, isn't it?
Yeah. Look, Charlie's music and his lyrics are incredible, powerful ways of communicating permaculture. He is one of the key global permaculture communicators, and that song is really incredibly empowering and a call to arms in the most positive sense. And I think also his very clear diction that people can hear those powerful words with that amazing music is quite a gift.
I believe we all came to be here for a reason. To acknowledge the seniors, everything has a season. This season is warm, but it's bringing a storm and a burning urge for our journey to transform. But held in our hand at this grave intersection is a map of the passage for a clearer direction to a permanent culture. It's time we began it with some wise design to realign with the planet. Share skills to rebuild our combined reliance, and with wild guidance redesign our diet. Befriend energy descent and the change in climate, to grow forests of food and a finer environment. Permaculture at this tumultuous juncture is a superstructure that can plug the puncture in a society of anxiety, confusion and greed. This really may be one solution we need to bring back our elementary essence of ethics and walk in earth care, people care, fair share epic. Now's the time to embed it while the temperature's tepid. Let us rise as a choir beside the people who get it, to guarantee that our future generations' lives are provided the conditions they require to thrive, instead of being deprived of the tools to survive in a biosphere too defiled to revive. So we invite you now to amplify the synergy, devise an inspired distinctive soliloquy, combining with like minds, an adaptable symphony of radical simplicity, balance and symmetry. Whatever your ability, we need your assistance. In aid of reclaiming a stable existence, go summon your gift at this critical hour and deliver wherever they move and empower.
Let us rise as a choir of the people who get it. And as you said, Jackie, and the people who care.
Yeah.
I think care is becoming such a big word. What a wonderful anthem.
Yeah.
You're right, though, David, with what you said, how he speaks, the words that he uses. I don't even think I could say them in a normal conversation, but he manages to put them all in that song. It's pretty, it's very talented.
He is, yeah. He has an extraordinary way with words.
That's a real skill.
And positivity as well.
Yeah.
And a twinkle in the eye.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's one of the things, Mick, we keep talking about, is that the people that we have on this show, the twinkle they have in their eye, they're vital people.
That's right.
And that... That gets me from week to week.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've certainly been inspired, David. Thank you very much. And as we always say when we end, and we say that because it goes back to that in the beginning, we were quoting Gandhi with the "Be the change," which is an important statement. But then Missy Higgins came with a song about being the difference. And we realized that this is really, you know, what it's all about. It is about daring to be different. Like, again, you know, if we rise as a choir of people who understand that it's not dangerous to be different. It's actually becoming normalized to be different in this permaculture sense. Then bang it. Then we have it. There we go.
Yeah.
Therefore,
be the difference.
Be the difference.
Terrific.